Intelligence organizations in Syria suggest that human rights violations in the war there were premeditated and planned by the government. More than 5,000 pages of information have been obtained by campaigners in Washington. They include this text written allegedly by senior government security officials, which we've translated into.
We received information that terrorists are being treated in Albert Hospital in Arrakhan in Homs. We suggest a gamut with our police.
3 days later, the hospital mentioned was bombed. I've been speaking to Mohammed Al-Abdallah, Executive Director of the Syria Justice and Accountability Center in Washington, D.C., and one of the people gathering the evidence and writing a report based on the document. I asked him how he got hold of the information in the first place.
So basically, these documents were rescued and sent to independent security from inside Syria during the conflict.
Also, there were other sets of documents were extracted by other organizations, private organizations.
You'll understand that many people have a vested interest in taking evidence in the Syrian conflict. You're absolutely sure that this is genuine stuff, are you?
Just sure this is genuine, so it's rescued and preserved by our own team. We have records and videos and films inside the security intelligence building. We took this video inside the division also to counter the narrative that I actually continue to demand that humanitarian aid is ending in that hand as well.
Given the documents that you highlight, are you surprised by the extent to which, for instance, that attack on a hospital was planned at the highest level?
To be honest, yes. I thought the military was conducting indiscriminate killing and they're targeting the political informants and information from the field. But however, I was really surprised that the head of the security entity or the security, the regional director of the security and intelligence in that area approved himself immediately the proposal of shelling and bombarding the hospital by artillery and aircraft.
It is potentially a smoking gun in terms of court evidence in the future.
I hope so, yes, absolutely. This is what we're trying to do. That's why we've rescued these documents and that's why we've done this really lengthy process of analyzing thousands of pages.
Let's hear this exhibit from your evidence, Mohammed. It's a voiced-up version of part of a memorandum from the director of Syrian intelligence. It's regarding the Kurds.
To study the Kurdish situation and understand their ways of living and gathering, the administrative and executive bodies in the province are directed to work to dismantle the Kurdish community, limit land and property purchases by Kurds, confiscate agricultural land owned by Kurds, to create state-owned development farms and employ Arab workers on them, develop a comprehensive plan to contain areas populated by Kurds, under the pretext of providing services to the Kurdish community.
What's your reaction to that kind of planning, basically to try and get the whole group out of the house?
Quite frankly, this is very fine. I corroborate what the Kurds have been complaining about for decades in Syria. Systematic state discrimination. To be at that highest level, clearly ordered to dismantle the Kurds. This is persecution of a whole ethnic minority.
Do these documents prove, you think, that the President Assad is personally responsible for the atrocities that you document?
We have not seen any document signed by Bashar Assad himself in the analysis so far. However, the nature of the order, the seniority and ranking of officials who signed these documents, and the nature of weapons deployed to conduct and deliver these attacks all suggest this is coordinated at the highest level, and Bashar Assad is not ordering, at least he's aware.
That was Mohammed Al-Abdallah, who's head of the Syria Justice and Accountability Center at Homebrew in Washington, D.C. You're listening to the BBC World Service for music. Coming up, how a company in the United States is launching a new program that sells products in reusable containers.
It's not that plastic is bad, it's metal is bad, paper is bad, plastic is bad if you use it once. And so we need to let these amazing materials go around and around and around. And so Loop was born as a mixing. How do we move an average consumer from disposable consumption to durable multi-disposable?
Headline: the British Cabinet has approved the Prime Minister Theresa May's latest plan for the Brexit bill, which offers compromises to attract the support of opposition MPs. Five Catalan secretaries who've been elected to the Spanish Parliament have taken an oath to uphold Spain's constitution following their release from prison for the day. And a trial has begun in Germany for suspected members of a criminal gang involved in trafficking 200 women from Thailand. This is Paul Hunley with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. And the Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, is to face a no-confidence vote in Parliament around a corruption scandal and the collapse of his right-wing coalition. His former partner, the far-right Freedom Party, withdrew from government on Monday after Mr. Kurz called for the sacking of one of their cabinet members. Bethan Bell is our correspondent in Vienna, and she joins me live from there. Maybe you could remind us, Bethany, of that video sting that began the whole crisis.
Well, the video sting involved the former leader of the Freedom Party. He was caught on video in a villa in Ibiza, in Spain, apparently promising a woman who was posing as the niece of a Russian oligarch big construction contracts in return for political and financial support. And he also seemed to suggest ways which he could circumvent Austria's rules on political donations. He sat down at the weekend. That wasn't a matter for Austria's Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz. He asked for the Interior Minister, the former Interior Minister, to leave as well. The Interior Minister today has just been fired, and all of the other ministers from the Freedom Party have been dismissed as well. But it seems that the Foreign Minister, who is an independent nominated by the Freedom Party, will stay in place. And the vacant positions are to be filled by technocrats.
So what happens now? The no-confidence vote is planned for next week, isn't it?
Yes, we don't know about all of this yet. One small party has said it wants to bring in a vote of no confidence against Mr. Kurz, and a parliamentary session has set for Monday. We will see which of the other parties decide to support that. At the moment, Mr. Kurz has been tasked with forming this technocrat government to fill sort of almost chair for the ministerial posts, which are now vacant. And he will be doing that over the next couple of days. Then it's the European elections on Sunday, and then this parliamentary session in which there could be a vote of no confidence.
This isn't necessarily a fatal blow to Sebastian Kurz, is it? A lot of voters were shocked by the apparent behaviour of a minister, but that minister wasn't from his party. He didn't necessarily stand to lose out.
No, indeed. I think the question is much more who fills the vacancies left by the Freedom Party. Can this government, which is now only half filled, manage to continue all the way to September, which is when the elections are about to happen, the new elections? Will there be votes of no confidence against Mr. Kurz? Will he survive them? What will the work of government be during this interim period?
We shall wait and see, and we'll return to you, Bethany, in Vienna as soon as there's further news. You're listening to the BBC World Service. European elections are just a week away, and in France they'll be taking place against the backdrop of 6 months of protests, some of it violent, from so-called yellow vests or gilets jaunes. Their anti-tax and anti-establishment campaign severely rattled President Emmanuel Macron, who's had to give out billions of euros in tax cuts and other giveaways. The gilets jaunes remain unsatisfied, and their protests continue. But what effect will their movements have on these elections, which for now seem to be dominated once again by the opposing pair, President Macron, and the far-right Marine Le Pen? Hugh Schofield has been on a road trip through the Gilets Jaunes heartland, department of the Loire, south of Paris.
my first pop has walked into a recreational area on the banks of the River Loire on the outskirts of the city of Orléans, where there is a Gilets Jaunes rally underway. The rally was pretty poorly attended, probably just 100 or so people, and they're all in a bit of a hoo-ha right now because they say the police have confiscated some of their cookies, of all things, and arrested some of their friends. So they're actually trying to decide right now whether to march on the police station, but they don't seem to be able to make up their mind.
Manifestation
Leadership is the big problem of the Gilets Jaunes. Basically, there isn't any. So these elections, they'll vote how they please. And there are a staggering 34 lists to choose from. Here in Orléans, there are anarchists and pillagists and communists. There's something with a new draft constitution for France that he's eager to discuss. But what unites them when it comes to Europe is their detestation. Pretty much of everything the EU currently stands for.
Qu'est-ce que c'est l'Union européenne? C'est une coquille?
What is the European Union after all?
It's a shell. And inside the shell, we put cover itself.
But what's been put in it so far
is an economic system which is capitalistic and based on a maximum profit extracted with a maximum violence. Well, we don't want it. That's all there is to say.
For my next stop on this tour, don't worry, I've come to this little brewery. But these two things, one, it's Canal Bridge over the River Loire, designed by Gustave Eiffel, and second, because it was the tiny aerodrome here in June 1940 that Winston Churchill flew for a meeting with the French government in a last-ditch but brave attempt to stave off the collapse of France before the invading German army. Briand is also the home of a woman called Jehan Shelley, of Tunisian extraction, who's the coordinator for the Loire department of President Macron's party, the LREM. Now, as also a deputy mayor of Briand, she's met many yellow vests. And she says she initially had some trouble with her cause, but she also says that a good 60 or 70% of this group far away back from the far right. And that she doesn't want. In fact, she says voting for the LREM at these elections is the only way of standing up against what she says is a leading populist enemy.
That's why I really organize things in the Loire and everyone else in France, and that's the message. I want the people to understand there's a danger and we should vote for Europe.
Kilometers to the north, around about at the town of Gien, and there are the people that Jehan Shelley doesn't feel comfortable with. It's the general position, and they're waving flags for the roadside and getting positive honks and thumbs up from the car. These are a different from the Gilets Jaunes or Lyon, who one felt were basically left-wing alternative types. Here they're also virulently anti-EU. But there's no compunction about saying which way they'll vote for Marine Le Pen and Rassemblement National, the best rampart against Macron.
Yes, exactly, to block Macron. We've got to show him that we don't want his politics anymore. We've absolutely got to get ourselves out from under him. And the way to do that is to vote for the only party that can beat him. That's Rassemblement National.
Conclusions after this brief tour of the Gilets Jaunes heartland? Well, they're still there, and their potential as a vector for populist anger is real. They will be back, but politically, well, worthless. In France, there's still only one battle, Macron Le Pen.
Paul Schofield reporting from the heartland of the Gilets Jaunes movement in France. This is Paul Henley with News Hour from the BBC World Service.
This is the BBC World Service. Michael.